Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow, published by One World, an imprint of Random House.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails, you ask? Well, we thought having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a really cozy idea. And today we're drinking the Black Shadow Martini inspired by Maurice's book. The recipe's on the Hot Redhead Media blog link if you'd like to make one and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Maurice's work, Maurice Carlos Ruffin is the author of We Cast a Shadow, which was published by One World Random House. The novel was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and longlisted for the Penn America Open Book Prize, the Center for Fiction Prize, and the Aspen Words Literary Prize. We Cast a Shadow was also a New York Times Editor's Choice. Maurice Carlos Ruffin is the winner of several literary prizes, including the Iowa Review Award in Fiction and the William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition Award for Novel in Progress. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Oxford American, Garden and Gun, Kenyon Review, and others. A New Orleans native, Ruffin is a professor of creative writing at Louisiana State University and the 2020-2021 John and Renee Grissom Writer in Residence at Ole Miss. His next book, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, will be published by One World Random House in 2021. NPR says of We Cast a Shadow that it is, quote, stunning and audacious, at once a pitch black comedy, a chilling horror story, and an endlessly perceptive novel about the possible future of race in America.
We Cast a Shadow takes place in the future and is a story in which a father attempts to protect his son from the racism in the world through a demelanization procedure that will fade his son's black birthmark, essentially turning him white. I don't want to say much more for anyone who has not read the book, but it is intense and especially relevant today, and we really can't wait to discuss the book.
How are you feeling today, Maurice?
Obviously, this has been one of the most complex years in world history, but today I'm feeling pretty good because I feel like I'm in a place where I can think about what's going on. I'm lucky to have my family and my friends, and So I feel pretty good.
Great. We're so looking forward to talking about your work and hearing you read a 10 to 15 minute excerpt for us today. It seems like it's so topical and it's such an important book at this time. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. And in fact, it was one of the highlights of the tour experience. You know, travel to 15 or 20 cities and meet people who had either read the book or were going to buy the book that night and be in a conversation with them.
Did you find any of the cities in particular more fun than others, just out of curiosity?
Well, you know, it's hard when you're coming from New Orleans, right? It's kind of hard. But that being said, when I think back on it, you know, it's hard to not appreciate traveling across the South. You know, I went to every state, all the major cities. I had a great time. I had a really great time in Boston, which was kind of surprising because people were just really into what I had to say. And I also had a great time when I went out to Portland and did some events out there.
New Orleans sets the bar pretty high, I have to say. Well, can you tell us where and when your story takes place? It seems like New Orleans in the story. And I have to say, before we go too much farther, that I taught your book in one of my classes. I think I told you about that. And the students were so interested in the setting and the place and the time and had all kinds of questions about that. You don't actually call it that. You call it the city. And I was wondering about your choices not to really name the time or the place for this novel.
Yeah, well, I think I was paying homage to writers like Colson Whitehead and his book, The Intuitionist, as well as Nabokov and Lolita, and others who just decided to either not name their protagonist or not name the time and place. And I think the reason why I did that is I wanted to create a story that was specific, but also had a certain feeling of ambiguity that made it universal. Because you know, the fact of the matter is people make a lot of fun of the South for things like racism and white supremacy, but it's an American problem. It exists everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I thought it made more sense to make it less identifiable, even though clearly there's a lot of New Orleans type traits. And then time-wise, it's set sometime in the future. I often say it's 40 and 50 years in the future, but you know, the current events telling us that is actually current in a lot of ways also.
Well, I'm going to admit something kind of funny, which which is that here I am in California, right? And I'm reading this. I'm like, it's here. I mean, to me, it could be here. It could be anywhere, right? I definitely think that you brought that across because there was so many rich themes in it and so many things to explore. I think I kept moving back and forth between the themes as I was reading it and thinking about it, which is all leading up to a question, believe it or not. This isn't just a long rant. I felt this book to be really engaging and fascinating as a satire, as well as a serious kind of literary novel because it alternates in its tone. How does this book fit into your view of your own kind of author's trajectory? And then I guess also, how did you start writing it or write your way into it when you began this narrative?
I think that every artist or writer or musician has a trajectory where they kind of hit their stride. And in the first work you hear from them, things are a bit simpler and a bit more direct, a bit more straightforward. I can think of any number of writers and musicians who fit that. And then there's this probably sort of level up and you sort of evolve and begin using more effects and making it a little bit more complex. So I think, for example, about one of the inspirations for the book, believe it or not, was Kanye West. And in his first two albums, when he was like a very young man, very popular, he had these songs about being in college, you know, about dating girls. It was all fun and games. And then he gets to this album called 808s and Heartbreak. And then after that, Dark Fantasy. And those two albums are way more complicated, a bit darker in tone, but also still funny in places. And I think that subconsciously, I was kind of following along where I had written short stories before the book came out that were, you know, just, they kind of hit one or two notes. And I wanted to make sure that this book hit as many notes as I had in my soul so that it could make you laugh, make cry, make think, make you want to throw the book across the room, you know, or make you want to, you know, gift the book to somebody for Christmas.
What an amazing thing. Like, this is what you're thinking. I want to be able to give it to someone for Christmas. That's such a good way of thinking about it as an author. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please feel free to keep going.
No, that was it. Yeah.
I read in an interview that you read Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Birthmark and Toni Morrison's Sula and landed on the idea of the son having this birthmark rather than a sickness, which I think was an earlier idea that you were working on. The birthmark in the story is such a powerful symbol. It's really difficult to imagine it as anything but that now. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about it because I'm working on my third book right now. And I recognize that there's something about the way that we look at each other. And there's something about the way that we think about our bodies that makes life both wonderful and also somewhat horrible. And I thought about some of the most compelling stories that I've either read or seen on television or films. And it's something about body horror. And it's something to do with the idea of either physical attributes that people don't appreciate or changes that make us feel uncomfortable. And so I hadn't even noticed it when I read Sula, which is my favorite Toni Morrison book. And it struck me the second time I read The Birthmark, this idea that you have this thing on your face, the spot or whatever you want to call it, that makes people see you as somehow other. And of course, that's a perfect stand-in for anybody who feels as though they have been alienated by society. Whether you are a woman and you feel like the patriarchy is oppressing you, whether you're a transgender and you think people don't see the real you, whether you're a Black person in America where you often are at the hands of the state or at the hands of banks who don't want to treat you like anybody else. And so I felt like that birthmark could be a good chance to have a very sort of clean symbol. And Nigel himself, in some ways, like Pearl in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, is also a symbol himself. So it's a symbol on the symbol. And these things are all sort of working together in my subconscious to make the story what it is.
Right. I think it really does a nice job of a manifestation, a representation of othering in the story.
Yeah. And something that's fascinating to me as I was reading it, I kept tracking the idea of whiteness and the idea of Blackness and how that was moving through the various symbology that the book was picking up and putting down as it moved along. And there was a lot in it that kind of for the narrator himself is really fascinating to me. There's so much in the book that kind of paints white as good in his perception and Blackness or Black as dangerous or bad for the main narrator. As a mode of self-protection, of course, and looking, especially when he's thinking about his son, but even to a certain extent, an internalized racism against Blackness, he himself feels, even down to the way he considers the actions of his own dad. So the way skin changes in the book is really kind of electric and metaphorical for how the characters either embrace or reject their own identity. Did you feel that identity was a thread you were following as you were writing?
Oh, definitely. Early on when I was writing the book, people would say, Maurice, what are you working on right now? I'd always say, oh, I'm writing this book about identity. And of course, it's such a vague explanation. But, you know, certainly identity is at the core of what's happening here. The main character is a father, first and foremost. He's also a husband. He's also a son. And so those parts of his identity are controlling how he responds to the world. And then you have his wife, Penny. And a big part of her identity is that, of course, she is a wife and a mother. She's also white, unlike the other people in the family.
Yep.
And then there's Nigel, who's a son, first and foremost, who's trying to be a good son to his father. And so those sort of tags, people often talk about identity politics. Well, everybody who's alive is somehow engaged in identity politics. Put that red hat on with white letters on it, that's identity politics. So identity is a big part of what happens in the story. And certainly I was thinking about that as I put it together.
A lot that took place in the book were also happening in the world when your book first came out and have always happened, have always been a part of the fabric. Racism, violence, oppression, protest. But in this year, this 2020 year that just won't stop, your book has found new readers as I follow you on Twitter and I've seen a lot of the dialogue about it. And it's resonated even more in light of the recent escalation of brutality, violence against Black people, the Black Lives Matter movement. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the response you're getting from readers today, and if it's similar or different than the response that you were getting when the book first came out.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny because I think every writer in the back of their mind has a sort of feeling for how big an audience might be. And, you know, for me, it was never about book sales. It was about writing the kind of book that I wanted to write, that I'm proud of. And so it had a good readership. And the people who wanted to read a story like this found the book and they bought it. They responded. And I got commentary from people. It was fine. But certainly, as soon as George Floyd was killed, and as soon as those worldwide protests happened, which is a first in human history, I mean, protests literally over the entire face of the earth, I saw the book sales shoot up. And the book has sold more in the past 3 months than it did in almost the entire first year that it was out.
So, oh, wow. Because it came out, when did it come out? The beginning of January?
Right. It actually came out on my mama's birthday, January 29th. And it did well initially. And like most books, that first month is great and it kind of tails off for a while. It was doing fine, you know, over the course of that year in between. But it just skyrocketed. And I even saw the sales spike yet again. And my guess is that it spiked in late August because professors are assigning it to their students to read in African-American studies classes, in political science classes, in English lit classes. And so I just think that for me, I've thought about this a good bit. I think in my mind, on the one hand, I was trying to write a book so that when a Black person reads it, they go, I totally understand why this is happening. I felt these experiences. I know what Sandra Bland felt. I know what Michael Brown felt. I know what Tamir Rice felt on that one hand. And then when people who are not Black would read it, whether they're white folks, Latinos, Asian people, whoever, they would kind of go, wow, I thought I understood how it felt in the worst moments, but now I really understand. So I've gotten a lot of those kind of comments from non-African American people in the past few months, far more than I did in the first year. Even to the point where some people who maybe were not the correct readers a year ago would read it and kind of go, oh, I don't get this, this is so far-fetched. I haven't heard any of those responses in the past few months. Nobody has said it's out the box now. It's because the book is literally about trying to avoid a child or a son being killed by police in the streets.
Well, I think that it's the privilege of people a year ago, 2 years ago, that would have read the book and said this can't be possible, that are now seeing things in a way that they never saw them before, finally, thankfully.
Oh, yeah. We were just having a conversation very recently, Ran and I, and actually one of the other authors that we're talking to, about how the idea of subtext becoming text, of conversations that were kind of not happening at a public level are now happening at a public level. Then we look at things like the various marches that are happening, the protests and all of that. And to me, it's beautiful when I see intersectionality in the protests. I love seeing people supporting this, not just Black people, all these different races of people coming and saying, yeah, this is wrong. This is not good. Something needs to change. It's time. And I think that's what's so topical about your book as well, is that as I was reading it, there was just so much interesting intersectionality that was going on in terms of what the book takes on. Of course, as you mentioned, the main character's partner being a white woman and an ally for one. Were you thinking about issues of shaping allies as you wrote this book? Because the book has one of this wonderful elements of being instructive, but it also potentially has this element of kind of demonstrating ally behavior in some of the characters. I'm always curious about that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's because, well, there's a few reasons for it. And I'll tell you as background, initially, Penny, the wife's name, was actually Allie. And I was playing with the idea of her being an ally. So that was there. And, you know, I'm lucky in my New Orleans experience, which is where I'm from, and that I have friends across the entire community, every economic class, all the races. I mean, we're all together. And a lot of my closest friends are white people. And I kept thinking about this idea of how their experience of the world is so different from my experience. So many things that I take for granted about my experience, they didn't know anything about. And so I think, you know, I've said this, you know, to my friends, that we have to be together. We have to have intersectionality when it comes to solving these problems of white supremacy in America. Because quite frankly, Black folks are not promoting racism. It's not beneficial to us. We don't need it. We don't want it. And so it takes white folks stepping in and doing their part, either in protest or in changing the educational system. And of course, when you see the old photos from the 1960s, there were plenty of white brothers and sisters there on the scene for the marches and for other things. So we need to understand that this is an all hands on deck type of situation. Especially in this moment, we recognize that with your best intention, what you know and what you feel, mm-hmm. there are always, at every moment, people who are against it. There are people who, if you said, look, you know, we just want to make an equal country, they would say, well, that's not a good thing. And you see it right now in the politics. You know, you saw it in the conventions. You see it in the way that the police are responding in some ways. And so we got to really push as hard as possible all together. Otherwise, it will not change.
Right.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the more people who get involved, the more power the ideas have as you're moving them forward to the legislature to like eliminate the institutionalization of various things and to create real change, right?
Yes, because on the one hand, there's what I call like the sort of overt power, which is people going to the streets and protesting and saying, we will not allow this to stand the way it is, which is very, very powerful. But on the other hand, there has to be a sort of change of the heart, which means that, you know, I think about the hypothetical white Harvard student, somebody whose parents sent him to school at that great university, and that student sitting in class, in maybe a history class or a civics class, whatever it is, and there's a good chance that in a lot of those classes, they're not learning a lot of true American history, the sort of things that are buried or forgotten mm-hmm. or not in textbooks. And so until we make it a point to make sure that those stories are told as a part of our mainstream story, we won't have any changes. And so we have to change on the top level and in the sort of, you know, back of the house, behind the scene level as well. Because until people understand why these things are happening, we can't address the issue.
And even on the in an English class on a syllabus that contains a bunch of old white men authors, that kind of thing matters too.
Yeah, and look, I mean, it's a strange thing, right? Because I'm not even right here to like offer an apologia for, you know, white male writers. I mean, but I can tell you that I came up on, I mentioned Nabokov, you know, Hemingway, John Cheever. Mm-hmm. There's a white comics writer who sort of invented the X-Men in some sense, Chris Claremont. I love these guys to death. The man who made The Watchmen, Alan Moore. And yet, for the most part, not a single one of those great writers, white male writers, addressed any of these things in their text or in their storytelling. And to me, that's a great failure because clearly this is one of the great issues of our American history. And obviously, it's affecting the entire world. And until we can sort this thing out, we can't be our best selves. We can't be that real city on the hill that, you know, Reagan talked about. So we have to tell the story, tell them honestly, have a reckoning and work towards reconciliation only after we understand what's really happening.
Absolutely. Now, you have so many issues and themes going on in your novel and a lot of heavy topics, but you also have humor. And I wanted to ask you a question. There's lots of parts that I laughed at and took me by surprise. And also, I'd have to say my students, too. And that was the thing that really drew them to the book. What is the role of humor for you as an author when you write?
Well, you know, I think the thing about it for me is, I mean, number one, my family's pretty funny. My mama, most centrally, is just a hilarious person. She would say the most off-the-wall thing. And I think being from New Orleans also is a sense of humor. It's impossible to be somebody who, say, works in the hospitality industry and see these sort of, you know, wacky tourists coming down from out of town and sort of like, you know, showing their worst selves on Bourbon Street and kind of being like, oh, there they go again, that whole thing. But then on a deeper level, there's kind of a limit to how mad you can get, I think, at least for some of us. Like, I think about one of my heroes, James Baldwin. I think one of the reasons that he may have died relatively young is because he was just so mad. And I can't blame him. I mean, he probably saw the American project clearer than any other writer in history. But he was furious constantly. I think that for me and my experiences, I think it's like if I walk into a gas station store, you know, to, you know, buy something to drink, and I see the guy behind the counter following my every move. The first time it happens, I'm kind of confused. Like, you know, why does he know me? Is he going to, like, tell me about a sale that's going on right now? If I come back, the next week and the same thing happens, I get really, really mad. And I kind of go, you know, why is the guy staring at me? I wish he'd leave me alone. You know, I'm not doing anything bad. But then the third time it happens, it's kind of like, oh, he's staring at me again. Well, you know, there's racism, my old buddy. It becomes like this almost joke. There's a level of satire that is built into the idea. I mean, look, even in this past week, this horrible murder up in Kenosha, you know, where that brother, I'm losing track of like what has even happened. But like my understanding right now is that after that happens at another protest, you have this young 17-year-old white young man. And the idea that he is like sort of carousing with police, giving some water, he shoots three people and kills two of them. And then afterwards, he just kind of like walks off and even like goes across state line. But that is so absurd to murder somebody and be seen as like a hero in some quarters. It's horrifying. And so that level of absurdity is right there with like Orwellian stories like in Animal Farm. Some of us, we're all equal, but some of us are more equal than others. It's just right there in your face. To me, I find it hilarious in the most darkest of senses.
Right. I mean, I have to say, it's funny. I'm really interested in your conversation about when you get taught these white male authors, right? If Nabokov is one of your models, if Hemingway, if these sort of things, they're in a sense instructive for authors in terms of storytelling and beautiful language and all of these facets, which is not to say that these other authors, people of color, aren't more impactful as you read them later, but which is also to say that I want to be sure I tell you, Maurice, that when I started reading this book, the very first thing I thought is, this is evoking Ralph Ellison for me in a really good way, Invisible Man. So that was the first thing that I thought when I started reading this book. And I'm glad for that now that you mentioned these things, because it immediately brought up an author who I have an immense amount of respect for, but not part of the white canon.
Yeah, look, absolutely, Ellison. I mean, that book is probably like 50% of the idea that spurred my storytelling here. That book to me sort of explains the Black American experience in America better than almost any book. I mean, I remember reading it as like a young man and thinking, how did he do this? Like, how did he manage to encapsulate so much of what is in our history in this one book so well? And so certainly in the opening scene, I was overtly trying to pay homage to the boxing scene in Invisible Man. That's like right there on purpose. Mm-hmm. And then it's the idea that, you know, I read much later about how he was treated when the book came out. Of course, the book, it won a National Book Award. It was a bestseller. But then I read some of the critiques by some white scholars from that period. It's like 1955-ish, whatever, you know, period was. And I remember like some of these white scholars saying, you know, obviously this is a good book for a Black man, but he is clearly not as adept at, in terms of his writing skills as many of our great white writers who we respect. And I'm thinking, wow, these guys missed the entire point. And I just like in the past month saw a tweet by an Asian American writer, in which actually it's the woman who wrote Pachinko. I can't think of her name right now, but she was talking about how a scholar at Yale, who didn't really know her very well, says you should really work on your English a lot more if you want to be a great writer. And she responded, it's not that I'm not a great writer, you're not a great reader. And that just stuck with me because it just, so many writers that I know and love, like Kiese Lehman, for example, who often writes in Ebonics or in Mississippi vernacular, he does because that's how young folks in this state sound. And I think that's a wonderful, brilliant, heartfelt way to do things. And I just love it to death. And so Ellison, Justin Ward, Jamaica Kincaid, all these writers are doing to me some of the best writing that you could possibly think of because it's so real and honest and important.
Absolutely.
Definitely. So you were thinking Pachinko by Min Jin Lee, right?
Yes.
And then just to add this for fun, is 1952, I just looked up, is when Ellison's very close. You were very close. But I thought I'd just add that in just as a little note there. And I just think that there's so much in this book that you could kind of delve into. Can you tell us a little bit more? I actually think that this book focuses very tightly on the son, on the father-son relationship. I felt like that was a very important thing in the narrative to you. Can you maybe talk about intergenerational ideas you were having as you were writing this book?
Oh, sure. You're bringing out a lot of the sort of backstory or like the sort of behind the music of the book, because the original title, one of the alternate titles of the book was Nigel. It's like his name, the son. Yeah, like I'm thinking about how I was taught early in my writing life about how you can have a book that has like, there's the narrator, there's the point of view characters, and there's the main character. And in some sense, Nigel is really the main character of the story, even though his dad is telling the story. Like I mentioned, the idea that for me, the genesis really comes from Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. But a lot of the sort of tone and a lot of the sort of theme comes from Lolita. And that book is being narrated by Humbert Humbert, but it's really about Lolita. And I sort of took that idea for this book. This is being narrated by the father, the unnamed narrator. But it's really about Nigel. So that same concept there. And then, of course, as a writer, there's always some biography and things. I thought about the best parts of my father, who was just a fantastic person all around. And so when I was trying to evoke the way that the father felt about the son, the way the son felt about the father, like the sort of bright parts, the good parts, I'm thinking about my own personal relationship with my own father and how he just taught me so much, was so loving, was so supporting. And so I wanted to make sure it had that, even though, you know, this book could be seen on some level as like a psychological, racial horror story. The actual relationship itself at its core is about love. And I wanted that to be a part of the story.
I was thinking about Nigel, and even though the book seems like it's about the narrator at first, you really come to understand that it's about Nigel. And especially as he ages throughout the book, it really, really does become his story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Ren, and I think what I was trying to do in part is that So I keep bringing up Lolita, but the reason why is because that is one of the most, I think, imitated stories in history. And what I found is that a lot of writers would try and make their own version of that story. Mm. Viet Nguyen, who wrote The Sympathizer, mentioned that he was thinking about that as well. And many other writers have done similar things. So you try to sort of correct the record or like give Lolita her voice, so to speak. And I had written my own version of stories that have been published in the past. And so I think that with this story, even though the narrator is in the sort of Humbert Humbert slot, I want to create a narrative in which the quote-unquote victim is empowered, is supported, has their own mind. And you can sort of clearly see in the outcomes of the book how this person understands themselves in a way that the narrator can never understand this person. And so, you know, certainly Ren, that was a big part of it, is wanting to show that intersectionality, that family love and support, and showing how that can affect somebody even under the worst circumstances.
Yeah,
definitely. That was all there. And I have to tell you, as a female reader of the book, it's always a pleasure to me when I can read about relationships among men that are not written in a completely closed off way, that are accessible to me. And so I was super interested in the idea of fatherhood and being a child. And I was very interested in tracing that as I was reading this book. And so I think that you definitely accomplished that goal.
Broader than that for me too is being a parent. And that was a lot of the conversation that we had when we discussed your book, is like, what would you do for your kid? That's like a really strong question to talk about when looking at this.
Yeah. There's so many stereotypes about Black maleness in particular. There's like these layers of, like, you have the toxic masculinity part of it, which is like, you know, men are just kind of no good, too rough, and too closed off emotion. Then there's the idea of the myth of Black fathers who don't love their children, don't take care of their children, who make all the wrong decisions. And I really wanted to make it a point to show how much this father loves his child. So that's why he, you know, has these sort of flashbacks recalling the first time he sees Nigel after he's born. Just like thinking about how Nigel smelled and how sunken in was, and thinking that he would never be able to get past that feeling of love for this kid, so that you could never say that the narrator just didn't care. You may question his choices, but certainly that level of love is right there. And even in reverse, I mean, a lot of the things that Nigel does when he is sort of questioning his own motives and choices is just, he loves his father. He wants to do the best that he can, even though it's confusing because it's such a complex situation.
Right.
Definitely. And I really think that the way, I don't want to give anybody any teasers or any information about what happens, but I do think that the narrator, as he moves forward, there's something really beautiful there about how you as the author are underlining that the loss of one person's identity can sometimes be the gain of another person's identity, or can compel the gain or closer lens on the idea of what identity should be embraced. I feel like I'm making this very vague statement, but I feel like I don't want to tell people anything about the really interesting plot of the book. I want them to go buy it and read it. So we can't wait to hear you read from We Cast a Shadow. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which is delicious, by the way, and it's fascinating. It's beautiful looking.
It is. It's beautiful and delicious. You're right. It's called the Black Shadow Martini, and the recipe's on the blog. It's very simple. It contains vodka, blue, curacao, and creme de cassis. And I was saving mine till Maurice reads, so I'm going to just get it ready. But it's very delicious. You put a little piece of orange peel in it. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, awesome. Maurice, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the excerpt you're sharing and then go right ahead.
Sure. And a question. I think there's one curse word in this section. Is that okay?
Go for it.
Well, first I want to say that I am very honored to be on Book Tales. This is a great privilege for me. And this is a great experience. So thanks for having me here.
Oh, we are lucky to have you.
Yeah. So I'm going to read from chapter 6, which is actually a chapter that I don't think I've ever read aloud in public before. And it's one of my personal favorite chapters. Actually, it's chapter 6 and 7. They're pretty short chapters. So,
ooh, we're so honored.
Yeah, it's a verse. It is like a world premiere. So the backstory here is that the narrator is a career man. He's trying to sort of move up the corporate ladder. He's a corporate lawyer at a big law firm in this city. And at this point in the story, he is trying to get a promotion because he wants to make enough money through a bonus in order to get a procedure to remove the birthmark from his son Nigel's face. Mm-hmm. And so in the preceding chapters, he's gone through this bit where the other Black lawyers who he was sort of competing with have all been fired. He's the last one standing. And so he sort of assumes he's been promoted. But somebody kind of says, actually, no, not so fast. You're not a partner yet. You got to talk to our boss about it first. And so in chapter 6, after a small fight, like a penny, the whole family gets in the car and goes to the law firm retreat at a plantation to find the narrator's boss and figure out what's going on. And I think I'm thinking about this chapter in particular because right now in Oxford, Mississippi, I'm in this gigantic house, which is not really a plantation, but it's on a big swath of land on 78 acres. So that feeling is kind of all right. So this is chapter 6 from my book, We Cast a Shadow. I'd never been to Shankstead Plantation. Actually, I'd never been to any plantation. I actively resisted. Every time someone tried to lure me to Harper's Alley or a carriageway for a day trip, I begged off. I'd lived in the city my whole life and swore that I would drink a cup of bubbling battery acid before I dipped my ladle in the polluted cultural springs of the hinterland. In my thinking, the entire South beyond my hometown was just one sprawling countryside. Ectoplasmic Colonel Sanderses on horseback chasing runaway spirits until the rapture. Hardly my idea of a refreshing getaway. Of course, I knew the basics from movies, books, and Joy Watson's fifth grade Gone with the Wind poster board, which I poured chocolate syrup all over before the start of class. Joey still won best presentation. He hung a mammy, gollywog, gorgon from the board. How could he not? However, none of my vicarious experiences prepped me for being on plantation soil. I'd never done a double take at the gleaming white chateau with shadowy, regular teeth columns. I'd never ridden up a rustic promenade across the same twigs and pebbles over which somebody's barefoot mom once hauled kindling. I'd never wondered if it was better for a pregnant woman to die from strangulation or a broken neck. What are those? Nigel asked. Penny squinted, her mouth agape. At first, I thought the wavering golden brown shapes dangling from the branches were Spanish moss. But I'd heard that all the moss was eaten by pests years ago. The shapes were fabric, perhaps a tip of the hat to what the plantation had lost. Strange fruit indeed. Good Lord. The Shankstead trees were positively crawling with branches. They looked like strung-up peat, Nigel said. God, he said. I hate this place so much. I steered us toward a clearing in the distance. The mansion was only a front. Behind it, in the forest, was a complex of hotel buildings, all done in an antebellum theme. The big house, a building with covered galleries on each of its four floors, was where check-in awaited our arrival. I don't know how this happened, sir, the lanky brunette at the front desk said. Your name is right here, but somehow we don't have a room for you. But we'll take whatever you give us, I said. After a conversation with her superior, the lanky clerk returned from the hidden room behind the desk and said, we found the solution for you, sir. She gave me a key card and beneficently pointed us to the narrow staircase at the back of the lobby. Upstairs, we found our accommodations. It was a mega room called the Planter's Suite. The bellboy, a little guy who could have been an older cousin of mine, brought our bags up. He could have been a cousin except for the work he'd had done on his face. You see, his lips had been deplumped, so that he seemed to grimace in pain as he pointed out the myriad gracious features of our quarters. The hot tub, the balconies overlooking the whole property, a basket full of complimentary chocolates, dark chocolate, milk chocolate, and premium white chocolate. At the door, as I counted off his tip, the bellboy gave Nigel a strange look. In such situations, I had to figure out what the person found unsettling, Nigel's face, my marital relationship, or the offspring of our union. These shadows followed us wherever we went. Sometimes I felt like we all had birthmarks on our faces. The bellboy shook his head. I realized from the way his eyes swept over each of us that it was probably a combination of all three reasons. Penny didn't notice. She was opening the curtain to let some daylight in. Nigel furrowed his brow. I sipped into his rum. I was no stranger to such audacity. Mixed-race couples were rare these days, having reached a climax during my father, Sir's, youth. Before the authorities overreacted to a protest by a black nationalist organization. As for the porter's distraction by Nigel's birthmark, that was just one more reason Nigel needed that procedure. I pinned the money to the bellboy's chest with my fingers. That's enough, I said. He took the money and left. I went to Nigel's room, one of the three bedrooms, other than the master suite allotted to Penny and myself. Balcony doors were open, and a brisk wind swooped in. Nigel sat on his bed, flipping through a book of colorful sea creatures. He wasn't looking at the picture, just turning the pages absent-mindedly. Nigel loved real books made of real paper. Bless him, my little weirdo. But occasionally he stroked the page, as if trying to switch over to the next screen. This place is cool, he said. It is, isn't it, I said. Nigel glanced at me, then averted his eyes back to the book. I closed it. He lowered his chin. That man, Nigel said, I don't like being looked at that way. Some people lack all refinement, I said. Would you speak in English? Nigel sat up. It's like he thought I was an alien or something. Hey. I grabbed Nigel's chin and considered what Penny would say if she were in my position. None of this is your fault, I said. Don't let anyone else's opinion cross you up. You're exactly the way you were meant to be. You sound like Mom. Such a smart boy. She knows what she's talking about. I wanted to tell Nigel about temporary injustice and how everyone had to persist in difficult situations until things cleared up. But the strings in my chest were too tight. Words were only words after all. You want a chocolate? He nodded. I made a square, wrapped, appear, and then disappear, using that sleight of hand that Sir taught me when I was around Nigel's age. Now, you're going to show me how to do that, Nigel said. I reproduced the chocolate between thumb and forefinger. I'll teach you, maybe, when you're ready. I dropped the chocolate in his palm. I am ready. He unwrapped the package naked. Not quite. Nigel groaned. Do you have your comics? I asked. He gave a thumbs up. I switched on the light because he'd read in the dimness if I didn't. Look, Dad. Nigel took a jar of Madam CJ's cream from his book sack. I remembered to bring it. The cream. I glanced over my shoulder to make sure Penny wasn't around, and I placed a finger over my lips. I'd forgotten that I had stocked Nigel up with several jars of the stuff weeks earlier. Based on my promise to Penny, I should have taken the jar away and explained that he wouldn't need it anymore. But the bellboy's gawking reminded me of reality. The cream was for Nigel's own good, after all. Remember, son, between us, I said. I kissed him on the forehead and went to the door. Be sure to wear your big hat when we go out. It's getting real sunny. Then I closed his door. In the hallway between his room and the master suite, I pulled a plum pill from my shirt pocket. The pill slipped through my fingers and bounced across the carpet. I picked it up. And without checking for debris, I popped it into my mouth. My esophagus lit up as that little elevator descended to my basement. Penny lay on our bed, a four-poster canopied special, like something out of Lady Chatterley. Everything all right? She asked. Hakuna Matata. I locked our double doors and turned on the stereo. There's a point where you've been married long enough that you can pluck hidden meanings from the ether. In the middle of our ongoing savage fight over Nigel's skin cream and how best to handle his vesicle problem, Penny had chosen to join me on this expedition into the heart of darkness. During meaner times, worse times, she would have allowed me to drive off without saying a word. But we'd sung together. We'd sung in the car. And that was a sign. In a full-on argument, she would have grumpily turned off that stereo. With a slight blush on her cheeks as that song ended, and that mischievous glint in the corner of her eye as the last note of our singing echoed against the glass, the subtle presence of feminine pheromone only detectable by the ever-so-slight itch in the back of my throat, unspoken communication, married folk semaphore, an invitation to a truce. A man has only two options in circumstances like these. Play it cool and risk that train chugging out of the station without you. Or you can climb into the engine cab, knock the engineer out, and toot that horn. I tossed my fedora onto a wine rack by the fireplace and undid the first few buttons of my shirt. The overhead fan shook, and the ferns around the room dipped in sympathy to those currents. You call for your mandango, Miss Penelope? I asked. Oh, hush, boy, she said, and flipped the smoke-gray sheets away from her naked body. I kissed the top of her foot and yanked her closer to the bottom of the bed. Once the sheets settled, we fucked a flame into being. And I can stop there. I'm not sure how we're on time.
That's perfect.
That's wonderful. I could just let you read to me all day long.
Yeah, me too. That was a really great excerpt. And I'm so glad we were here when you first read it publicly. But what I like about it is that it really shows the conflict within the narrator, how he's constantly justifying doing this procedure for his son, not being honest with his wife about it, how he constantly is like telling himself all the reasons why he needs to do what he's doing.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes this moment so hard for so many of us is that none of us really want to cause trouble. None of us want to make the sort of choices that can make our own lives difficult. That's understandable. And I think that one of the things that is admirable about this narrator is that even in the face of maybe damaging his relations between his wife and his son, he is relentless. He will not give up on trying to execute his plan because he thinks he has no other choice. And that's really something that we should think about, I think, in this moment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I'm so glad that you read that excerpt for us, though. I feel really honored. And also, of course, I didn't mention this to you before, but I'm a huge Nabokov fan. He's like one of my favorites. So now that you've said this, I really hear him evoked, too. And by the way, my favorite short story of all time being his story Sounds. So it was so neat to hear you talk about that and also get your insight into the generative background you were thinking about stylistically in terms of writer's craft as you were writing. So thanks so much for this reading, Maurice. It was so great to hear you bringing your work to life with your voice. So all the hearts, all the flowers.
This was a great pleasure. Thank you for having me on Book Tales, and I'll come back anytime you want me to.
We would love to have you back. So for now, why don't you tell us about your next book and maybe what you're hoping for in terms of your creative work or your publication agenda for the next 12 months.
Sure. So my next book is called The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. And that's going to come out next August, 2020, so about a year from now. And it's a short story collection that's going to include stories that I've written over the span of about 10 years. About half of the stories were written before 2015, and then the others were written within the past maybe year and a half. And really, it's my best work. It's what made me the writer that I am. And the sort of theme is that the stories are all set in New Orleans, actual New Orleans. The characters are all African American. And it's designed to show a real cross-section of the community that I come from that made me what I am. And I give credit also to my good friend, Sarah Broom, who wrote The Yellow House. We're contemporaries. We're from the same neighborhood, mm-hmm. New Orleans. And she won the National Book Award last year. And so I feel like what she's done in nonfiction, I'm doing in fiction. This book is coming out next year. And then my next project is going to be a novel. It is still untitled and it's still not very defined conceptually. But I'm going to try to capture the African-American experience in America over the course of centuries. And how will that happen? I have no idea, but that's part of the fun.
Well, I can't wait to read both of those, especially your short story collection. I love short stories, and especially one that takes place in New Orleans. But thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really, really enjoyed talking to you and hearing you read.
Well, best to you. Please stay safe in this time and keep doing your great work. I think this is a wonderful project you have here, and I look forward to hearing more episodes myself.
Okay, so everybody who's listening, go get Maurice's book for sure. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Booktales readings and drinks for this podcast series. And also subscribe to this podcast. It releases once a month, and there's going to be more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Booktales today. See you next time.